All right, members, we are going to go ahead and get started on the State Government Finance Wednesday, February 22nd. I'm looking for someone to approve the minutes. Representative Green, did you have a chance to peruse the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Okay, Representative Green moves the minutes. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have first on deck House File 409, Representative Albright, and I believe you've got testifiers, but also am I missing some? I believe former members of the committee are supposed to bring treats for the committee when they bring back a bill the first year. Representative Ward, is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Representative Albright, your treats are coming?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I'm going to go ahead and move Representative Albright's bill since he's no longer part of the committee. I'm going to move House File 409 to the committee. And
here I also have an author's amendment that I would like to have moved to get the bill in the shape that I would prefer it as we go forward testimony.
Okay, and Representative Albright, that is the A5 amendment?
A5 amendment, yes.
Okay, I will move the A5 amendment to put the bill in the form that you'd like. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, it is approved. Representative Albright, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And the purpose of just as a moment of explanation on the A5 amendment was to just give better clarification to the broad market index applicable to investments that are applicable to this to offset the pension liabilities in concert with the SBI and some of the other folks that we've consulted with. They would prefer that to be the measure of consideration as opposed to what was previously in the bill. So I appreciate you taking that action to put the bill in the shape it is. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to just make some quick remarks and then turn the rest of the time allotted for this bill over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carlson. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Inter-County Association that consists of 10 regional center greater Minnesota counties and four suburban counties here in the metro area. I do want to thank Representative Albright for introducing this bill and getting it through the process. I also want to indicate, besides our organization, this is supported by the finance directors from Hennepin County, Ramsey County, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the City of Minneapolis. Just very briefly, the purpose of this bill is to expand what has been existing authority for local governments since 2008 to invest funds for certain long-term obligations with either the State Board of Investment or with other limited types of mutual funds. Under current law, there are over 22 governments that have used the authority that's mirrored in this bill to set aside monies to offset liabilities for what's called other post-employment benefits. In reality, that's retiree health care. The reasons why that was put into place is that there was a change in accounting standards that required us to account for those costs on a has-the-cost-accrues basis rather than the prior practice of doing it as the money was actually paid out. Over $390 million, in fact, over $500 million have been invested for this purpose with the SBI to date. In addition to the current law, there have been other accounting standard changes that have exactly the same effect, changing governmental practices from a pay-as-you-go type accounting to accounting has the cost to actually accrue with regards to pensions and with regards to capital cost. Finally, we've had a long obligation as counties, cities, to the extent we operate a landfill, just like the private operators, we're supposed to set aside monies for financial assurance that closure and post-closure costs, when those facilities are closed at some time in the distant future, monies will be there to pay for those costs. So that's a very quick overview of this bill. I have distributed a copy of a memo prepared by Doug Anderson, the executive director of the PERA. that spoke to what this means to the agency. They basically do the front end of these monies and the back end of these monies. The actual monies are transferred from them to SBI for investment under one of the options available in this bill. And I'll just point you to the third paragraph that says the administrative responsibilities for PERA outlined in this bill are consistent with PERA's administrative responsibilities for other post-employment benefits, again, retiree health care. And then going on to the second to the last paragraph, in the middle of it says, given our experience administering OPEB plans, the structure to administer this proposal is in place and effective. And the letter further indicates any costs that they have are provided for in this bill, and the fiscal note identifies that. Any costs are offset by fees charged to the local governments that would elect to do this. Currently, they charge $500 annually to cover these costs. The reason why I brought up this letter is that there was a motion in PERA offered by Auditor Otto to say that this was inconsistent with the mission of the agency. I frankly take issue with that because they're already doing it for the one purpose I identified, but do want to inform the board that on a 6-vote, 6 out of the 11 members, that motion was passed.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. I think because you mentioned the fiscal note, we should have Ms. Roberts walk us through that. Members, that's part of your packet. If you can take that out, Ms. Roberts will explain the fiscal note.
Madam Chair, members, there are two agencies that have responded to this fiscal note. You'll see on the front page the fiscal note shows no net costs, and that's because if you look on the second page of the fiscal note, you'll see the summary for the State Investment Board that has expenditures of $11,000 in 2018 and $8,000 ongoing, and then PERA having expenditures of $10,000 per year for the first year, and then $4,000 ongoing, and then those costs are offset by the revenues from the fees that are charged to the local governments. And if you want to look at more detail on these costs, the PERA costs are outlined in a chart on page 5. So these are costs for setting up forms and setting up the initial counts. And then the SBI costs are discussed on page 8. And again, these are staff costs for setting up accounts and are covered through the fees.
Okay. Is there anybody from the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Please step forward. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rebecca Otto, the State Auditor. I attempted to get a hold of the author. I had not heard back, so I felt it was my obligation to come in and testify on this bill. There's a couple of different pieces. The Government Finance Officers Association, the GFOA, which some of you may be familiar with, they collect and publish information on permitted local government investment in the 50 states. And according to the last published information, no state permits the investment of tax money in any of the above investments in this bill. Now, I know there was going to be an amendment. We've been tracking this. But generally, the idea is that you do not take undue risk with public funds. Now, Keith Carlson, we had tried working with him on this for a while. We still had concerns. And he referenced the landfills and investments around that. That happened in 1984. And that was with trust. So when you set up an irrevocable trust, those are really truly long-term investments. And long-term investments you can take more risk with, because over time the idea is experts would agree that you will make money over time. But if it's for a short period of time, you're taking more risk. So the money that is being proposed to be invested in this bill would be more like your operating revenues. And it's not put into a trust. The concerns we still have are that it's a lot of money. It sounds like it's limited, but we did some rough numbers, put together the cash and cash equivalents for Ramsey County, Hennepin County, St. Paul, and Minneapolis. And if you took 15% of that, it's $334 million that can go into equity. So we're going to be an outlier as a state. Again, this is not for trusts. The other concern I have is that they're saying it's for long-term obligations. But in the bill, there's no time period, a minimum time period of investment. And so it's possible for a city or county to put some money in and then take it out within 2 years. So there's no restrictions currently. And if it's truly for long term, there should be something in the bill that states a 15 to 20 year investment time period. And then it might be more appropriate to take that additional risk. Another piece that I wanted to mention, too, is because there isn't another state that's allowing for this. We would be the only one. If a city or county invests, let's say, $500,000, they put it in 1 year, and 2 years later they decide they need it for uncompensated absences. And the money is now only worth $150,000, not $500,000. Who's going to cover that, the loss? Is it going to be the taxpayers of the city or county? Is the state going to provide a bailout if they've lost money? Let's say that there really isn't any value anymore in their investment at that period in time. So the reason I came today is because as a state auditor, and I do this very, very rarely, but this is one where I am concerned about the risk that public funds could be subject to. They're not being put into a trust. There's no time period that they're being required to invest in. I do serve on the State Board of Investment, and I don't know if an attorney has analyzed this, but it looks like there's an amendment potentially, and I don't know if you've passed it yet, that's going to have State Board of Investment start to develop policies and procedures around this. My question for an attorney would be is, in SBI can ask it themselves, but do we have some sort of a liability if we don't get it right? So, again, if there's a loss of these funds, who's responsible? Who's going to pick up the tab if they're invested and then they need to be pulled out? Those were my main concerns. So this is different than a trust. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Auditor. Members, are there any questions for the auditor? Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to respond to the points that have just been made, I think that there needs to be recognition of specific definitions that with regard to specific investment protocols. While it is true that most municipalities handle most of their investments on their cash accounts in what we would consider a cash management account because they are of a short-term nature, when you take a look at the generally accepted accounting principles that would govern the type of risk and or liabilities that pertain to the investments and or the responsibilities that are pertaining to House File 409, they are generally understood to be of a long-term nature. Now, while certainly we can put language in there that would address the long-term nature from a finite perspective, whether that be 10, 15, or 20 years, the specific reason for this bill is to match up the liability with an offsetting asset of a long-term nature. And the rationale is there's different types of risk. When you take a look at the types of risk that are inherent to a cash management account, they are to ensure, as Auditor Otto specifically said, that you preserve principal. But when you recognize that the nature of the health care benefits that are adjudicated under this bill are of a long-term nature, and with health care costs rising at on an annualized basis about 6 to 8%, you need something that will identify with the long-term nature of the investment growing at that similar rate as opposed to a cash managed account, which is traditionally invested in T-bills up to 1 or 2 years in nature to match up with the intended purpose for those investments. And they arrive at a rate of probably no more than 2% impact on inflation. So what we're doing in this bill is to recognize the marketplace and recognize that we're matching up an asset to match up with the liability over the long-term nature. And with that, the risk associated with that necessarily needs to be of a different variety. And I'll leave my comments at that.
Okay. I see the fellow in the second row there. You had wanted to testify as well. Why don't you come forward at this time, please?
Madam Chair, can I just, there's something I need to talk to you
about. In just a moment, we're going to have this fellow come, and then we'll get back to you. So welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Doug Anderson, Executive Director of Public Employees Retirement Association. And I just wanted to reference, Keith Carlson mentioned a few comments from a staff memo that I wrote for the board, and just wanted to clarify that we were seeking a position from the board related to PARA's administration for this this bill. And the discussion from the board just included that the focus of PARA, our mission, is to promote sustainable retirement plans, and that this would be outside of the scope of those services. Currently, we administer plans for over 500,000 participants in five different types of plans. This would be providing some administration that isn't consistent with providing retirement benefits.
All right. Thank you. Members, any questions? Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to summarize, you say you didn't take a position because it was outside the scope of what you thought was your purview. Is that what you just said?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, the board did take a position to oppose the PARA's administration of the bill because it's outside of the scope of our mission.
Thank you.
Representative Ugo.
Thank you. Director, okay, it's outside the scope of your mission, but my question to you is, if this bill passed, you have the capacity to be able to administer it.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we have the capacity based on our understanding of the current scope. There's concern about whether or not the scope could change to allow more qualifying governments, and also uncertainty about the frequency of the transactions. So based on our best estimate and assuming that it's consistent with how we administer our other post-employment benefit plans, based on that capacity, we thought is manageable with current staff.
Thank you.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, the position taken by PARA is understood, and in conversations with those entities, we understand that there was a split decision on that, but as Mr. Anderson has said, they have the capacity to take on this responsibility, and I would also adjoin my comments to the point of that in most cases, retirement benefits packages also have a health care responsibility as well under Taft-Hartley or others. And so in our opinion, as is the position of Mr. Carlson, this would be not dissimilar from the responsibilities thus far.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Is there anyone else besides Madam Auditor that wants to testify on this bill? Madam Auditor?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Accounting standards were used a couple times, and so I just want to be very clear because it's complicated, especially government accounting standards. It sounds like it's been, it might be believed that by allowing them to take operating revenue and invest it, and they say, and this is unassigned cash, it's not assigned, and it's not going into a trust, that somehow it's going to lower the liability on the financial statements for any of the items listed. It doesn't. So in accounting standards, unless you put it into a trust, it does not impact the liabilities. So you're not going to impact the liabilities on your financial statements for your pensions or anything else. So so although that would be nice, you have to put it into an irrevocable trust in order to have that happen. And this is very different. And there's nothing stopping a local government right now from putting money in it 1 year and pulling it out the next and putting it in. So I know you're putting some responsibility in State Board of Investment to determine policies and procedures, but again, I worry about the liability, reputational risk. You know, we mostly invest in pension funds. And so, again, it does not assist local governments in accounting at all or their liabilities. From what I understand, they want to be able to invest in equities in order to potentially grow money, but we have to clearly understand they can potentially lose a lot of money. And the question again will be, and I know Representative Albright doesn't want to take undue risk. I don't believe that, right? But it's a factor, and if there is a government that invests a large amount, and they can invest quite a bit, and there is a major loss, and they can't, it's no longer there, who comes up with that money? Who's going to pay? Property taxpayers, the state, and it's a reality. So in our office, we're very conservative. We're there to protect the taxpayer. And I wanted to share my concern because the concerns were not all dealt with in this bill. And I want to make sure you guys do this with your eyes wide open. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Auditor. Okay, Representative Albright, any response?
Madam Chair and members, we recognize that there is risk in anything in life, and the risk adjoined to these types of investments is very well understood, not only by the individuals and the municipalities that have undertaken this effort to provide this opportunity for them, but also by those folks at the SBI who have been in concert on these and have guided us. I will note that in a number of other respects, whether it be in pensions, on the pension board, or any number of other boards, the state and the administration of the state also weighs in on those. And so the risk is understood at that level. We're understanding that this risk is no different than that taken on by other boards for the long-term nature of the liability that is adjoined to it.
Mr. Carlson?
Madam Chair, if I could just respond to some of the auditor's comments. First, frankly, I'm quite surprised because all the issues that Auditor Otto has identified with regards to the expanded purposes for which we can invest under this bill exist for the current investment authority for other post-employment benefits. Contrary to what she said, the trusts set up for other post-employment benefits can be liquidated at any time. The school district where West St. Paul has withdrawn all its money invested with SBI without regards to the term of that investment. So there's no term limitation under the current law. The risk for loss exists under current law. One of the investments that are available to governments generally is bonds. As most of the committee members know, bond values fall and rise with the interest rate. When interest rates go up, the values of bonds go down. When interest rates go down, the values of bonds go up. You can look at the financial statements for the cities and the counties, and they do show losses in their investments because of that character. There are far more exotic investments that Auditor Otto apparently is not concerned with that are available to some local governments right now, such as repurchase agreements, reverse repurchase agreements, futures contracts, and I've never heard a concern with that. In terms of not being able to offset the liabilities with that, I'm sorry, that just shows a fundamental misunderstanding of the basics of the balance sheet. We have liabilities for pensions. Every local government is reflecting a portion of the $7 billion of unfunded accrued liability on their balance sheets right now. We need assets to demonstrate to the consumers of our financial information, include bond purchasers, the bond rating agencies, that we have sufficient assets set aside to meet those liabilities. There is no requirement under current governmental accounting standards that those monies be invested in a trust. All we do have to do to demonstrate is that we have the assets to meet those liabilities when they actually come due in the future. The same is true with in terms of long-term capital investments. The characterization of the landfill cost, the state is allowed under current law to set aside its money for cleanup in these equity investments. Local governments cannot. The private operators could. We're just looking for parity because this is a long-term investment. Finally, there's been a suggestion that we are taking operating funds to do this. That's simply not correct. We're not raiding our operating funds to do this.
Okay. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson had hit on a number of the points that I was going to talk on about. But many of the people who are on this committee probably aren't familiar with finance and investment and things. So there are some terms that were tossed around, and the teacher in me feels it necessary to maybe just kind of simplify this a little bit for us. Mr. Carlson talked about the fact that communities could invest in bonds or other types of things, maybe certificates of deposit. And having been involved in municipal government, you have needs that are going to be in your first year needs, your second year, third year. And so you start putting money aside, and you may invest those in 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5-year maturities as your needs occur. The assertion that was put forward that what happens if that money is needed at some point in the future. That same argument could be made if a community experienced some kind of a loss or some kind of unforeseen expenditure or repair that costs several million dollars. They would most likely have to liquidate those assets, potentially, as Mr. Carlson said, at a loss because they were bonds, because bonds are, the way interest rates go up, the value of your bond goes down because your return on that bond is just less than it would be, or having to pay penalties for cashing in other investments. So that is a universal up and down the spectrum of safe investments versus those investments that are more at risk. So I just wanted the committee to have the benefit of that. And my suspicions would be that the county hired an auditor to come in and do their books and issue an annual report, or the city or the school district, whoever would be authorized under this, that would show up on an audit that there were those assets that had been used for that purpose and the expenditure, whether or not those were proper use of those assets for the particular need that the community had. So just wanted to provide that. No questions, just a little bit of background. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then Mr. Carlson, I guess, or Representative Albright, either one. The auditor stated that the bill should state the investment period within the bill itself, how long the money is going to be invested. I'm not sure if you answered that or not. If you did, I might have missed it, but why shouldn't that be in the bill, or should it be in the bill?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, for exactly the reason that Representative O'Driscoll outlined, there may be some emergency event that's been unanticipated, and those funds would be used to offset the costs relating to those emergencies. These funds are not being invested for their purpose, but they are fungible and can meet what otherwise were the operating revenues set aside for those purposes if they go up dramatically because some emergency event. We have to maintain some flexibility to be able to anticipate the events that, you know, we can't possibly budget for on a routine basis.
Representative Johnson? Okay. Members, any other questions? Representative Albright, you've got the final word.
I'll just shut up and sell, Madam Chair.
Wise choice. With that, we're going to lay this bill over, House File 409, for the possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. Thank you, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Okay. Representative Lunan, welcome to the committee. Representative Lunan. Welcome to the committee, Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for hearing the bill.
I'm going to move House File. It's House File 1010, laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, members. This bill is a lights-on bill for one of the biggest employers in my district, Canterbury, and also the running ACES. What it is doing is, in the event we aren't able to solve our work here in a timely manner at the Capitol, it will dedicate money that's already been collected by the Racing Commission for this very thing and reallocate it at the same level it was at the last year of the previous biennium. So the money's already been collected. It's not expanding any of that. It's just doing an automatic appropriation. The importance of this bill for Canterbury and Running Aces is that industry, its revenue season is very, very short. It's a very seasonal industry, yet the work and the costs go year-round. And so while they're at the peak of their opportunity to actually make money and pay their bills, that times always at the same time of year that if there's any problems over here, and I'm not anticipating there are any, this is a just in case, if there's any problems over here, that we've got some safeguards for those people. This is an important industry for the state of Minnesota from an agricultural standpoint, from a tourism standpoint, and the fiscal impact exceeds $100 million. It's a big deal. Part of my reason for wanting to do this bill is some of you have been around long enough where we've had this happen before, where we had to stop and figure out some negotiations. And to this day, it's beyond my understanding of why or what the basis was for what businesses were picked that were to remain open and which ones were picked that had to close. It seemed a little bit capricious to me, but that might just be that there were some things that I wasn't aware of. And I have some testifiers today that would like to speak to the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Andrew Hoffman, Director of Racing Operations at Canterbury Park. Thank you for your time and consideration of this bill. Canterbury Park, as you've seen from receipt of letter of support from President and CEO Randy Sampson, is in support of this bill, and I will keep my comments brief as I'll mainly be elaborating on his letter. In short, the government shutdown in 2011 was extremely devastating for Canterbury Park and Canterbury Park stakeholders. The employees that were laid off, the horsemen and horsewomen, both those that are local and rely on our meat to make their ends meet during the course of the summer, and those that come from out of state, as well as our vendors, all suffered extensive damage as a result of the government shutdown in 2011. Additionally, as the impact on Canterbury itself was substantial, as I mentioned, the detriment caused to the local economy as a result of racing shutting down at Canterbury Park was severe, and the fact that with no revenue to run for, all of our local horsemen and horsewomen, again, both those from Minnesota and from outside of the state, had no money to pay their bills, to pay the salaries of the employees, to pay money for feed, to pay money for tack, all of that made in the state of Minnesota. Additionally, as we've gone and looked at other states, we've never seen a similar instance of this type of shutdown occur at a racing commission agency level. That goes throughout 30 different states and over 100 years of the regulation of racing throughout North America. As I mentioned before, we do draw a substantial number of people from out of the state of Minnesota, and they rely on this meat to make ends meet for them and their families. And if they are not able to have confidence that racing will continue uninterrupted throughout the state of Minnesota, there's a lot of other places that they can take their business. And it's a very, very challenging requirement to ask them to come up here, spend 5 or 6 months in the state of Minnesota, when many of them come from the southern part of the country, and pass 6, 7, 8, 9 other racetracks in their journey here each year. So for those reasons and those stated in the letter of support from Randy Sampson, Canterbury Park is in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And Mr. Fulton.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Court Fulton, and I'm with the Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association, which is the thoroughbred horse racing organization in Minnesota. And I'll reiterate that, you know, every year we try to get people to come from all parts of the United States and Canada, and it's a big deal when somebody makes that decision. And I can't say enough about how harmful it was back in 2011 when we shut down this activity, and we had a really difficult time talking people into coming back. And we got a lot of negative feeling out of that. But I'm going to try to talk today quickly about the basis for this. And I'm aware of this amendment, and I would like to make I don't know what you're going to do with the amendment, but I would like to make a suggestion. Because, try to do this really fast. Since 1858, our Constitution has not allowed the spending of state money without an appropriation. It's one sentence. It says, no money shall be paid out of the treasury of this state except in pursuance of an appropriation by law. Back up until 1913, there were a lot of standing appropriations for agencies, and they issued warrants against the treasury, and that's how a vendor or somebody else that the state owed money to got paid. In 1913, there was a reform, and we shifted over to what we still have today. For the most part, it's a two-year biennial budgeting process, which is not codified. So when the 2 years ends on a certain July 1, that budget ends and the authority to spend thereunder ends. But we have another animal called a standing appropriation, which goes back further than 1913. There's still a number of those that existed then, and we've created new ones. One of the new ones we've created is the Minnesota Racing Commission. And they, as they take money from us, because we fund our own regulation, as they collect this money, you, by statute, have appropriated it back to them. So it's a constant flow of money in and money out. That is a standing appropriation. It is not like the biennial appropriation. It doesn't have to be reenacted every 2 years. There's a, I don't know, as time passes, these names disappear, but Peter Watson was a giant in the legislature. Now, he was a Senate staffer, but he's still a good guy. And he wrote a really great publication called The Power of the Purse in Minnesota, reiterating that it's the legislature that decides what money is spent, not the governor, not the judiciary, as we had back 6 years ago in 2011. So the arguments against us, and we litigated it to the extent we could in 2011, constantly told us, but the legislature didn't pass the biennial budget. And I kept arguing, we are appropriated money as soon as it comes in by legislative enactment. Then there were some procedural arguments made about, well, who's going to write the checks? Those arguments were made despite the fact that the administrative process was continuing on anyway to service what was called core functions. Now, most of you probably know the core function exemption, that everything has to shut down except what the governor and a district court judge consider to be a core function. It sounds like good public policy, but I can assure you there's absolutely no support for that concept in our state constitution. So where we were at in the end was those functions that the Constitution allowed to take place because they had legislatively appropriated money were shut down. Functions that the Constitution does not allow to continue if they cost money were allowed to continue because they were called core functions. Now, I wouldn't want to vote against core functions if I was in the legislature or the judiciary because all havoc would have occurred. But this bill is intended to clarify what we believe is already clearly the law and make it unified because our law for us was passed in different bits and pieces. So to make it clear and unified, because you don't get much chance to litigate. By the time you get a formal hearing or something, the shutdown is over with, and now you're a moot case, and we run the risk of this happening again. There's an amendment before you. I don't know what you're going to do with the amendment, but it's a lights-on amendment, and we saw a lot of this back in 2011. It never got done. The problem with this is it's comparing an apple to an orange. The lights-on amendment would be appropriate for biennial budget items, but on page 1, line 2, you have a delete everything clause, which means our bill would go away. Our bill deals with standing appropriations, not biennial budget. And if you don't save the original House File 1010 and add this to it if you want to, I'll have actually put my people in a worse position than they were before I walked in that door an hour ago. They're two different things. You can do them both, but I would ask if you're going to do the amendment, don't delete the bill. It's a different animal, and we need it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holton. I think members at this point, we're going to see if there's anybody else that wants to testify on this bill. Okay, and if not, members, do you have questions right now, or would you prefer to go to amendments? No questions at this point? Okay, Representative Kunesh Podin, you heard what his comments are. Are you looking then to change your amendment? And I know Mr. Gehring could probably help us out with, rather than doing the delete everything after enacting clause, still including Representative Lunan's bill, or what are you looking to do?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for explaining all of that to me and to this group. I'm a new legislator, and sometimes we think we're doing things in the best interest. I also have a sister who's a horsewoman and has horse. I understand what it takes to make sure that they're well taken care of. I'm just coming from the perspective of my own personal experience in a shutdown. In 1996, the government shut down. At that time, I was a single parent. I was running my home daycare. I was going to school on the weekends. I had saved up just enough money to get me through my student teaching and maybe an extra month before I could get my teaching license, and graduated in December, expecting to be able to apply for my license in January, and the government shut down. And I was pretty much penniless at that time. And thank heavens for Minnesota, I ended up having to take assistance from the state. And so for a good 6-7 months, I was on public assistance because of the government shutdown, not through my own fault or anybody else's fault. And so when I look at this bill, I guess I ask how can we pick and choose who gets to stay active and who doesn't? I mean, teaching licensing is very important. The ability to get into our national parks is really important. Job services, the veteran service, all those things are really important. And so I just, my reason for this amendment, or why I agreed to carry this amendment, is because when there's a shutdown, there's a huge effect statewide. It's not just horses. It's not just teaching license. During the 2011 state government shutdown, 19,000 state employees were laid off. The lives of hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans were adversely affected by that government shutdown. Had it been able to continue, that would have affected and gone into the millions of individual lives. And when you consider the cost of preparing for that 2011 shutdown, the revenue lost during that shutdown, the employment payment to lay off the employees, and the recovery costs after the shutdown, the 2011 shutdown actually cost the state more than it saved from the payroll cost. And so I'm not sure what to say as far as that amendment goes. It sounds like it could be detrimental in a way I didn't know, but I'm wondering if I could ask Matt to explain this amendment, and then I would have a better way to answer you.
We're actually going to have a Ms. Roberts kind of walk through how the appropriations work. I think there's a little bit of a confusion on that piece. Ms. Roberts?
Madam Chair, members, yes, I wanted to clarify how the Racing Commission operations are actually funded. If you look at the bill, House Bill 1010, and look on lines 1.20 to 1.21, under current law, it says receipts in this account are available for the operations of the commission up to the amount authorized in biennial appropriations from the legislature. So the legislature does directly appropriate from the special revenue account every 2 years for the operations of the Racing Commission. So in this part, this is not a statutory appropriation. This is a direct appropriation that needs to be reauthorized every 2 years. The commission does have some statutory appropriations. If you look on page 2 under section 2, this is limited to the reimbursement account, money received by the commission as reimbursement for the cost of services provided by veterinarian stewards, et cetera, are deposited in the state treasury and credited to a racing reimbursement account. And then it does say on line 2.9 that 2.8 and 2.9 that receipts are appropriated to the commission to pay for the cost of providing those services. So I just wanted to clarify that the actual operations of the racing commission itself do need to be appropriated every 2 years.
Okay. All right. Representative Lumen.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And the request, Representative, would be, I mean, we'd still work with you on your amendment, but have your amendment be added on to the bill rather than actually literally replacing the bill. What that does is my intent of the bill with Canterbury and running ACES, because it's a different animal, it already collects its own revenue and in the special revenue fund, it actually would be a detriment to them the way it is. And I understand what you're trying to do, mm-hmm. and I'm happy to work with you. I just ask that if you'd consider the mechanics of, and I don't know how to do it, but amending it onto my bill rather than deleting my bill and then we replace it with yours. That would be my request.
Okay. I think I would be in agreement with that. Okay. So do you, at this time, do you want to pull your amendment or how do you want to do it?
Okay. I'll do an add-on.
Okay. So I'm guessing then what we would probably add on is just the Section 2. Mr. Gearing, can you help us with that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Commissioner Boudin, so I think the process would be that you do an amendment to the DE1 amendment to delete the instruction on 1.2. So instead of saying delete everything after the enacting clause and insert, you would modify the amendment to instead say on line 1.2, page 1 after line 6, insert. So you're just replacing the instruction in the amendment to provide that it's not a delete everything, but is instead just an addition to the existing language of House File 1010.
Representative Kanesh Podin, does that make sense? And Mr. Holton, while she's thinking that over.
I have a question for staff, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
On line 1.3 of the amendment, would that become Section 5 then?
Mr. Gearing?
Madam Chair, no. So if this amendment were adopted, we put the sections in statutory order, so this would continue to be Section 1 of the bill, and then the rest of your bill would just follow after that.
I see.
Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah, makes sense?
I agree.
Okay. So I think do we need to do that first, Mr. Gearing, then? Okay. So if you can restate it so we make sure everybody understands exactly what we're doing here.
So, Madam Chair, then the amendment to the amendment would be on the H1010 DE1 amendment, line 1.2, delete the instruction, delete everything after the enacting clause, and insert, and instead replace that with the instruction page 1 after line 6, insert. And again, the effect of that is to, instead of having DE1 act as a delete everything amendment to replace everything in the bill, it just adds the section that's in the DE1 to the existing underlying bill, so it all would be contained in the same engrossment.
Okay. And, Mr. Geary, we need to adopt that first, correct? Okay. So, members, does anybody have a question to the amendment, or the amendment? Okay. Seeing none, all those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Are those opposed?
No.
Okay, so now we're getting back to the amendment, the DE1 amendment as it is, and I'm going to move to amend that as well, Representative Kunesh Podin.
Madam Chair,
yeah.
If there are people here to testify, would now be the appropriate time to ask you to let them be heard?
Is there anybody that wants to testify to this amendment? No? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director at MAPE. In my capacity, I represent 14,000 of the state's professional state employees. I'm in support of the amendment. Our board has taken a position in support of the amendment. I think some of the arguments we've already heard here today are would be what I would repeat. One thing I would add is that 80% of our state spending continued during the shutdown in 2011. In July of 2010, the state's spending equaled about $2.6 billion, while July of 2011 during the shutdown was $1.8 billion, so 80%. And I think the representative already reiterated 19,000 state employees were laid off. Over 7,000 of those were the people that I represent. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We represent 43,000 employees, state, county, and municipal employees. The amendment before you addresses the state employees, of which many of ours were laid off with the last shutdown as well. And our employees basically do not want to put a human face on this, do not want to be used as pawns in a shutdown. And the amendment before you would assure that that would not happen.
Great.
So we'd be in support. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any questions for the testifiers? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. Members, I'm going to move to amend the amendment on lines 1.6. After the word again at, insert 95% of. And, Mr. Gehring, will you repeat the amendment?
So Madam Chair, the proposed amendment then on the DE1 draft, line 1.6, after the phrase, in effect, again, at, you would insert 95% of. So then that whole sentence would read, if a major appropriation bill is not acted before July 1st of an odd-numbered year, the existing appropriation amounts pertaining to that bill for the fiscal year ending June 30th are in effect, again, at 95% of the base level through the fiscal year beginning July 1 of the odd-numbered year.
And members, the reason behind this amendment is if we are facing a budget deficit, we don't want to continue to spend money that we don't have. Essentially, so it helps to protect the state against putting themselves into further deficit, essentially. So that's what the amendment does. Is there anybody that wishes to testify to the amendment? If not, all those in favor of the amendment?
Sure.
Oh, Representative Ugham?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm interested. Representative Driscoll, I believe, voted against this. And I'm a little uncomfortable with marking this up so fast with some of the intricacies involved here. I'm just wondering, Representative O'Driscoll, what your opinion was on this at this point in time.
Well, Representative Uglum, this will be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, too.
So we may have a chance to look at it again.
Yep.
All right. There, I'm more comfortable now, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm much more comfortable.
Great. Representative Johnson, did you want to comment on this?
No, Madam Chair. I was just looking for the rationale behind the 95% and concur with you.
Great. Any other questions, folks? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. To-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Putting for working with me. We talked about her amendment and what we were both trying to get done, and I appreciate we were both going to go away with what we're both looking for.
Representative Luna, I missed one step. I apologize. I'm going to interrupt you one second. So now we need to adopt the amendment as amended, and we haven't done that piece, so I apologize. So all those in favor of the DE1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. I apologize. Representative Luna.
Well, I'm not going to thank her again. members, this provision for the people in the horse industry is important. These are people that basically
have a financial existence that is, the margin is very, very narrow. They're not in this, you know, to be wealthy or whatever. That's who this affects, and I appreciate your support on the bill.
Okay. With that, the bill is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus state government finance bill. Thank you, Representative Lunan. Members, we are adjourned.